Khan. How you doing?
Oh, I'm hanging in there. I don't know. It's middle of the second semester, so what more can you say?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's got that vibe to it, especially once, you know, it's supposed to be nice and warm now and you're getting February temperatures back.
Oh boy. Yep. Yeah. I totally feel it. It was like 70 degrees last week and I was outside tanning and it was
beautiful. Well, so, you know, for those of you just tuning in, Ilias, you are a member of the Sunrise Movement in Pittsburgh.
Yes, yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about Sunrise?
Yeah, 100%. So I'm actually the hub coordinator of our local Sunrise Movement hub. And what Sunrise Movement essentially is and does is it's a youth-oriented climate justice movement. Right, so it's not just an organization, but really it's a concept of how to make change around climate change and climate justice on a local level. And my job, really, with Sunrise Movement is just to make sure that we are engaging with our community and we are, you know, moving apace in terms of making actual direct climate policy change. So that's kind of my position, and you know, over the past 2 years I've been in the position. You know, it's been really wonderful to get to know and really work with Allegheny County communities on issues of climate justice.
So what are some ways that you've kind of practically worked with our communities in Allegheny County and worked to kind of push for change?
Absolutely. So there's been some really wonderful things happening at the county level, particularly
when Trump started issuing his executive orders. I saw universities start scrubbing their language without being asked. I saw universities start deleting environmental justice. First off, I was pretty proud, actually, that as a movement, we've gotten to a place where there is a president trying to erase us from history. I don't want to carrot my way into compliance with people who are trying to kill us, because in our neighborhood, it's very clear the industry wants to kill us, right? They put toxic chemicals, they put arsenic, mercury, dioxin into the air. That means they don't care about the kids who have to grow up in that neighborhood. That is not negotiable for me.
That's Maria Lopez Nunez, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Maria Lopez Nunez on environmental justice. Parts of the United States are an eco-disaster, a sacrifice zone. Take parts of Newark, New Jersey. If you travel down a one-mile stretch of Doremus Avenue in Newark, you pass a natural gas plant next to a sewage treatment facility, next to an animal fat rendering plant, next to a series of ominous-looking chemical storage containers behind acres of fencing. Airplanes pass overhead every 2 minutes, their engines rattling windows, while a putrid smell wafts from the open pools at the sewage treatment plant. Nationally, where are these polluters located? Overwhelmingly in poor communities of color, like the Ironbound section of Newark, where activists are organizing and fighting back to create a just, vibrant, and sustainable community. Our guest today is Maria Lopez Nunez. She's deputy director of the Ironbound Community Corporation in Newark. She's an environmental justice organizer and plays a large role in activating and uplifting her community, while also pushing for policies to address environmental injustice locally, regionally, and nationally. She spoke at the Environmental Law Conference at the University of Oregon in Eugene in March.
Hi, everybody. I'm Maria Lopez Nunez. Happy to be here in Eugene, Oregon. I'm from Newark. Well, I'm from Honduras. I was born in Central America. Most of my life, I grew up with people not knowing where that country was, actually, until Trump put us on the map his first time as a country. So you know, very excited. Haven't traveled the country much except to visit other environmental justice communities. So, of course, community, I'll tell you about mine first. The community I've served for the last 10 years under Ironbound Community Corporation, and that's in Newark, New Jersey. So Ironbound is a 4-square-mile neighborhood, right? Just 4 square miles in the city of Newark. Most people fly to Newark to go to New York. Actually, when you land in Newark Airport, they tell you you've arrived in New York, but you're in a different state. You're actually across the river in New Jersey, Newark, New Jersey. And Newark, New Jersey is home to the longest Superfund site in the country. That's 17 miles of a Superfund site. That's our Passaic River. The river surrounds us on two sides. It's a Superfund site because during the Vietnam War, we were the largest producers of Agent Orange. You know, Diamond Alkali, the producers of Agent Orange, had plants along the riverbank. They knew at the time that they had other ways to produce Agent Orange, but they chose to do it in the most toxic way. I guess if you're going to use it to poison people overseas, who cares if you poison some people at home, right? No need to do safety. So they were dumping the byproduct dioxin being, you know, one of the most cancer-causing things to human beings, straight into the river. I've talked to many workers that have now rare skin disease. They talk a lot about the white dust that covered everything in the plant. And that white dust would get on the truck wheels and then be wheeled all across the neighborhood. So I used to have colleagues that would swim. You know, there was a swimming pool in the neighborhood at the time. The swimming pool had dioxin in it, eventually having to be closed. There's actually some iconic pictures of neighborhood residents sitting, you know, on their stoop, on their porch. And these people from EPA, newly formed EPA, they're in toxic hazmat outfits, right? Looking like they're astronauts and people freaking out because they're in t-shirts, right? So we start seeing the divide of the community versus the experts pretty quick in the neighborhood of Ironbound. So the longest Superfund site in the country. It has over 100 brownfield sites in that 4 square miles. We are also host to the largest garbage incinerator in the state of New Jersey and in the region, and the largest sewage waste treatment facility. The sewage waste treatment facility would deal with the waste of 12 different states. So they would barge in waste into the neighborhood to be dealt with at PVSC. It's called the Passaic Valley Sewage Commission. I need y'all to understand what that smells like, right? That when you're dealing with the waste of 12 different states of over 4 million households, obviously that's not the people that live in our neighborhood. That's not even the people that live in our city. We were responsible for the waste, the human waste of 30 different municipalities. So, you know, I like to say, people don't think about things, right? You flush the toilet, do you give it a second thought? Maybe, if you don't feel good. I've had the pleasure to have to think about waste a lot. Waste of what happens when you throw something out. I should have started by saying, I don't believe in recycling, right? And I hope no one here does too. It's a sham by the fossil fuel industry. And in our neighborhood, we really got to see that plastic buildup, how plastic was changing the waste composition and changing what the incinerator was looking like, because plastic's not good for them either. It's too light. It burns too fast. It was making their process really out of control. So they had over 700 violations. I believe firmly that's because they were in a black and brown community, because there are incinerators, comparable incinerators, that would only have 40 violations in the same time period. So when we're talking about 40 to 700, that's an exponential increase that you see in a city like Newark. What I say about our city is we're not a poor city. You know, I hate a lot of environmental justice. It's often this conversation of pity, of, you know, we need to have empathy and sympathy for people that are in bad conditions. I saw it as a story of theft, right? Of theft of our resources and our human potential. Most of the people making billions of dollars off of our city's resources and land, they didn't live in our neighborhood. They didn't even live in our city or even close by. So Superfund site, the largest incinerator, the largest sewage waste treatment facility on the East Coast. And then we were also home to the largest port on the East Coast, right? The Port of Newark and Elizabeth is where 80% of the consumer goods in the Northeast come through on, you know, these huge ships from Asia so that we can all purchase all our crap, right? So when I think about that, when I think about everything from the dollar store to Fifth Avenue coming through our neighborhood, I think of all the money that just runs by my neighborhood. So it was interesting to be part of an administration that was trying to change that through Justice 40, right? So for those of you that don't know, Justice 40 was an attempt, a guidance, if you will, learn the difference between mandatory and guidance, right? But a guidance that 40% of our resources should go to 40% of the population that is of color, that is marginalized, low income, neglected communities. Look, I'm not a linear thinker, so you're going to have to come with me on this journey. I hope I won't bore you. That is one of my rules for organizing. Don't be boring. And I would say most of the environmental field, it can be kind of boring. It can be kind of boring to listen to. You glaze over and community members stop listening to the organizer at the front of the room because our strategy for too long has been to shock and awe people, to make them afraid, right? In our small neighborhood, our organizing revolved around being friends with people. Very revolutionary. Making your neighbors your friends, you know, making it so that your neighbors want to hang out with you, that not every time that you're knocking on their door are you coming to them with a problem to solve, of like, you know, there's another thing coming into our neighborhood. So biggest, longest Superfund site, the garbage incinerator, the port of Newark and Elizabeth. And then we were home to 3 power plants. And as of today, we are about to be home to 4 power plants in a 4-square-mile neighborhood. So when I think about that, you know, I think about what our neighborhood looks like. You would say it's mostly industry and then a little bit of people squeezed in there. And how I think I started making my mark in environmental justice is just because right place, right time. Anybody from a community could end up on a national circuit or being appointed to the White House. I think it's because, you know, as we partnered with lawyers and academics, it was so important to fight for our space as the community voice. I mean, you have no idea the insecurity to have to speak to a public interest law, you know, environmental law conference to say, well, I don't even have an advanced degree. You know, I do organizing and I've been at the White House quoted as saying regular ass people. Like, that's who we need to fill these rooms with, not just have rooms that are exclusively of lawyers or exclusively of academics. You know, while I was helping serve under the Biden administration, I was seeing that the rooms were too exclusive. You know, it was filled with professional advocates, quite frankly. Where do we have the real reflection of, like, who is in the room with us? Are there people that we don't know? Are there people that don't look like us and that have different life circumstances? Because if they're missing from the rooms, we're kidding ourselves to think we're going to go find them later or that somebody here knows them. Because if if you know them, why aren't they in the room with us? So I have a lot of rules for organizing. I'm just going to sprinkle them in whenever. But like I said, one of them is definitely don't be boring. I think it's a criminal sin to bring people out to an event and then bore them to death. I would say don't be dumb. And I struggle with don't be dumb. Don't be dumb for me means if you don't know, don't pretend you know. That's what dumb is to me, right? When people pretend that they know something or pretend that they know a community because they know one sort of like it, communities in this country can't be generalized, as we saw during the elections, right? This might be controversial, but I'm okay with the fact that a lot of our environmental law, our efforts on climate change are burning down because I don't think a lot of them were good enough. In 2019, I was part of passing the country's strongest environmental justice law. It was called S-232, the Cumulative Impacts Law. Cumulative impacts is to address exactly what I was talking about, right? four power plants, a garbage incinerator, a sewage waste treatment plant, the Superfund site. The law did not allow our State Department of Environmental Protection to just do what a fourth grader can do. Look around. Look around and say, huh, there's way too much trash here. How the hell are you going to add another power plant? Because in this country, permitting works in the way that I, being from a different country, American, you know, ideology works. Individualism. Every single power plant and facility is seen as an individual. Or is that individual facility going to go right up to the permit limit? It doesn't matter who's around them or the context of the neighborhood in environmental law. They're judged by themselves. They're not judged based on the in a contextual nature to look around. The best we had was maybe there was a cumulative impact assessment. So many of our laws stop at assessment and then leave things up to the discretion of professionals. Professionals who are often white, who are often, you know, from privileged background, who may have never stepped foot in our neighborhood. If they could step foot in a neighborhood like Ironbound, they could see that you can taste the air. You should not be able to taste the air in the way that we can, which is that garbage? Or, you know, I forgot to say my favorite. We're home to a fat rendering plant in Newark. For those of y'all that don't know, fat rendering is like they take animal carcasses and they boil them until the fat separates from the bone so that we can, you know, engage in all sorts of beauty products so that you can get your gelatin for your gummy snacks, all sorts of products. It's called Darling. And that really was quite a smell. It became my favorite because it's the easiest to report, right? It smells like a dead animal that was being shipped on these open containers. So we would often in our neighborhood see the dead animals. They would spill all over the place on their way to the fat rendering plant. And that's what the kids in our neighborhood have grown up with. So when I think about our neighborhood, it is generations of kids that are impacted. When I think about our laws that, you know, we set goals that will be achieved in 10 to 15 years to people doing the work that I do, that's generations of kids that are going to grow up in the same conditions because things do not move fast enough. You know, we let the law play itself out. I have been sitting across lawyers countless times where they're like, hey, this seems great. They're going to phase out in 15 years. And I'm like, we have different priorities. This might look like an excellent settlement to you. For the people in our neighborhood that I am accountable to who used to know my address, right? And I would bump into the supermarket. I can't come back to them and say, your problem will go away in 15 years. With the cumulative impacts law, first off, it mandated that if a community was low income or language isolation or more, or it was 40% people of color or more, that probably indicated some sort of political vulnerability. And as we know, New Jersey's nickname is the Garden State, which makes no sense if you've been around New Jersey. But for the Garden State to be real, a place like Newark has to exist, right? Which is where you dump everything because of zoning. All the industrial cities, which is where the majority of black and brown people existed in our state, that's where you have the heavy industrial zoning. And so under that law, the Department of Environmental Protection has to take a further look in to see if a facility will contribute to the excess burdens, right? If they're actually going to increase that totality of burdens that are happening because of the different facilities. So what was interesting about that, first off, big fight to get those numbers down, to make sure it wasn't like a preposterous number. I believe industry wanted it to be like 70%, which would have been hyper segregation, right? We're 40% of the population, just about. So we're like, no, anytime that there is a further concentration. But the point is, anytime that they were looking into that, if a facility was going to increase the burden, then the department shall deny, right? It was not may deny. It was, they had to deny that application. And that was it. It wasn't anything revolutionary. I'm almost, if I'm honest, embarrassed to talk about that law across the country because it's such a low bar. Yes, a neighborhood has already been harmed for generations, for decades. Yes, this neighborhood already has such a high concentration of pollution. The people already have adverse health outcomes. One out of four kids in our neighborhood has asthma, right? Like, it is a terrible air quality. We suffer from, you know, high infant mortality rates, all the different statistics that I won't go into because you already know them. After we already found that that is true, we're not going to add yet another power plant, even though our governor just approved another power plant despite this law passing. And that's because, as y'all know, probably better than me, between a law passing and a law getting implemented, it's quite a distance. And so the law passed in 2020. And then in terms of making the rules, we did change how rules were made. As y'all know, a law passes, very exciting. Then an agency typically goes dark. They don't talk to anybody. Well, they don't talk to any community. They often do talk to their regulated community, right? That's where the word community is used. It's in the regulated community. So they actually were talking to us, community advocates. And it was interesting. I feel like both the life of the head of legal and my life were changed in that process because I was able to humanize the government worker on the other side and see what they were up against and to see just how much they didn't know about our community and the way that and the ways that we were impacted. So we were able to work together every other week we were meeting to just discuss, you know, different points of the rules and what we thought, which I thought I was fascinated by. And I was like, why aren't all rules made like this? Shouldn't they be made hand in hand with the stakeholders who will need to utilize these processes, with the organizations that need to spread the word about, hey, there's going to be a community meeting? Because to say there's going to be a community meetings about rules for a law is, again, it goes into the very boring category, right? It is hard to communicate that to people who are busy in our neighborhoods, who have three jobs, you know, have kids in school, or have so many competing interests. And then we have to tell them to attend a rulemaking thing. So in our fight for the EJ law, the unions got involved, obviously. They saw the law as slowing them down. I'm super pro-union, and I have to acknowledge that there is a lot of racism in some of the unions in our country, as we saw during this presidential election, as we see when certain unions, and I'll distinguish, right, certain unions have been against the climate legislation, the IRA, and so how do we reach out to folks like that to help them see themselves in that future? That's what, you know, in our movement, we talk a lot about the just transition. It's really about helping everyday people see themselves in that future. Because I have to acknowledge that when we talk about the Green Revolution, it doesn't even sound like it involves people from my community. It doesn't really even look black and brown. Forget about, you know, working class white American. It looks elitist. You know, we've been sold. Somehow Tesla went first, and now we see that all the horrors that are being committed at the White House. But Tesla was the face, right, of what a green revolution might look like. I was in rooms with a lot of environmental people talking about EV cars. I was like, what? First off, where are you getting that electricity from? This idea that anything electric is inherently good has been so destructive, because in communities like mine that are home to four power plants, we know that electricity is not neutral until we transform the grid. We're not going to be talking about electric appliances and cars. Like, we are, you know, kind of too far ahead in the story when we have to have some fundamental changes to the system. Let's see. In terms of organizing, please, A, I hope you remember, don't bore people. Two, don't assume that you're going to trauma bond with them because things are so bad. When we're fighting the sludge processing plant, our campaign slogan was stop sh**ing on Newark, right? Like, just cut through the crap, man. Say what it is. Say what it is and say it directly. Don't try to flowery language it. So many people are afraid to say what's really going on or how bad it is. You don't want to sound inflammatory, right? But I'm like, don't. Then you sound inflammatory in a very, you know, kind of almost waspy way where people are like, wait, is there a problem? Because there's too many formalities, right? Too many disclaimers and qualifications for the statement instead of just stop on Newark. Why did I say that? Because the head of the head of PR for the sludge processing facility, he said it, he had the audacity to say in an article that the way that they decided to come to Newark is they followed the feces, you know? And so to be part of a neighborhood where people have the audacity to be quoted in a paper saying they followed the feces, I saw it. I was like, perfect. Thank you. A perfect organizing opportunity. So we had very clear language. And that made it so that the politicians who were not on our side, they were like, hey, this isn't that bad. Like, first off, don't assume that politicians know what they're talking about. I would say, like, put yourself in a politician's shoes. There is a crowd of people, and I call us the pitchfork crowd. And I am a proud member, okay, of the pitchfork crowd. But I acknowledge that if you're facing a pitchfork crowd and everyone at a community meeting wants to, like, spit at you and be, you know, like, yell at you for things that may or may not be in your jurisdiction, that's a big thing that I try to teach our community members about, like, let's all learn together, because I don't know always, right, of who are we complaining to? Do they have the power to change it? Because so often we're not complaining to the correct people. And so that leads to definitely to a lot of frustration. Two, how do we build relationships with those people? Yes, they're expected to serve us. They're public servants. You know, that's what they signed up for. Sure, sure, sure. We can say that. But they're human beings, right? And if you're facing the pitchfork crowd, and then on the other side, industry looks seductive. You know, they're over here like whining and dining them, telling them nice things about themselves and having that relationship that does get built up over time. I think it's important then for us on this side to figure out a way to build relationships with elected officials. And that means that we don't always build our relationship when something is wrong. We need to actually really pay attention to them, because we're all human, right? Even the most, I don't care what anybody thinks, has a little people pleasing in them, especially if they decided to run for office. I think that must be the most, like, I want external validation. So it would be, we need to keep validating people by showing up to their hearings, to their boring ones, when our issue is not on the topic, is not, you know, on the agenda, because they're like, ooh, I'm being watched. I do think that as we're complaining and putting out criticisms on Trump, how at the local level are we showing up for democracy? Democracy doesn't happen because someone makes it law or not. We are the people that make democracy happen. You know, we have to show up. So when we were fighting that sludge plant, I had all the elected officials and we were showing up to all their things. So even though they were all on the side of the sludge plant, they ended up having to have a community meeting talking tough and coming out against the sludge plant. I don't know what's happening behind closed doors. I was aware that we were being played, but all that matters is the public record sometimes, right? Let me talk about my colleague, Ana Baptista, Dr. Ana Baptista. She's at the Tishman Center. 10 years before, when they were working on the zoning plan, and this is why it's important for all of us to get involved in minutia and boring things, then we don't have to tell our friends about the boring thing, but we have to be involved with them. She was able to get a list of exclusions, one of them including no sludge processing, right? So we're there, and I had been talking to lawyers who just wanted me to file a petition, and I was very unsatisfied by that. I was like, no, I don't want to just file a petition. We're going to lose if we wait for this to drag out in court. She wakes up. We had 5 hours left to the deadline. I was like, I guess there's no other option. And she remembered that 10 years before, she had been able to put in the exclusion, no sludge processing. And they were clearly a sludge processing facility. So I was able to go back to the lawyer and say, we're switching the strategy. We're going to forget about the permit, you know, because we're always fighting the permits. By the time they're at permitting level, it's probably too late. It is very hard to fight a permit with agencies that think that they are meant to serve industry. They don't think they're meant to serve us. No matter how many times we say Environmental Protection Agency, Department of Environmental Protection, that's not what they're doing. They're serving industry. How do they make it as easy for them to comply with the law? Because the law is so subpar and does not really protect us, right? It's just a license to pollute, really. That's what I think most permitting laws are.
You're listening to Maria Lopez Nunez on environmental justice. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online our website, alternativeradio.org.
And look, this is not to discredit the wonderful work. I know it's been hard. But for communities like ours, we've been failed by Democrats and Republicans for decades, you know? So when I think about environmental justice, we're not terribly shook about Trump because it is more of the same and just somehow unveiled, right? Like, I often don't know, is it better for you to look like my friend or act like my friend and betray me or just be outright betraying me? I think our communities are grappling with that. And that's why there's been so much disinvestment from our communities in these past couple of years. So with the sludge processing facility, we then changed, you know, we changed the battleground of our fight and we came to the local level. We had over 250 people on a zoning board meeting. The reporters were like, what the hell? It was 1 a.m. and we were still fighting with them, you know, keeping these commissioners on way past their bedtime, right? They're not used to public engagement. And that's something the right has done extremely well, is show up at the school boards, you know, boards that we've let go by because we're trying to fight the big fight at the federal level. With the environmental justice law, we had Chris Christie at the state. So we decided to pass a local ordinance at the city level in Newark in 2015. We passed the EJ local ordinance. So I would say right now in the times of Trump, we really do need to think about our state and local strategies. And not just say state and local strategies, like actually, what are you going to pass? What are you building right now that then when the circumstances change in 28, when there's a transformation in 2028, we're ready for it. We are ready to suggest the laws that should pass. And then we could say, you know what? That law exists in Eugene, Oregon. You know, it was passed in Eugene first, then Portland, and then it became Oregon state law. And so we want to model after that. With the EJ law in New Jersey, we've helped people work on it in New Mexico, in Minnesota, in Chicago, in Baltimore. You know, there's been so many other states trying to emulate us. And we've been trying to make sure that they all keep the bar where it is. Shall deny. I'm like, none of you better go for a may deny or an assessment. You know, you better keep that bar, keep it strong, build on top of it. Make sure that it includes renewals. Our law does not include renewals. It only includes like new facilities, right? So in a lot of ways, our law is just about stopping the future pain. It doesn't do anything to correct what the harm that has already been done. So let's see. Yeah, don't trauma bond with people. Make sure you have concerts and your places where people just dance and party together. Because like I said, no one likes that friend that only comes around when there's bad news. You know, that friend's emotionally toxic. So don't be that friend if you're organizing. That also means that if you're an academic or a legal scholar or a lawyer that's working with a community, don't just show up to the meetings about the bad thing. Show up. And hopefully they're a good community organization, but that they are doing things that bring people happiness and that serve people's other needs. In my bio, it was talked about the Compassion in New Jersey law. I'm fully environmental justice, but we were working on making sure people weren't getting evicted. Because guess what? When people don't get evicted because of the work you did, they're going to show up for you for a hearing. That's how I was able to get, you know, hundreds of people to show up to a rule-making meeting. And that surprised. I mean, I had union members following me into the bathroom trying to intimidate me and make me back down with the EJ law. I've had my house broken into, my tires slashed, my dog let out, right? Like, industry doing just enough to let me feel insecure. I come from a country where environmental advocates are just shot in the face. So I'm kind of okay. I'm like, hey, you know, we're in the U.S., you probably won't kill me, and that feels pretty good. So I think we should all feel a little sigh of relief. We're as bad as it's getting in this country. We need to always remember how much worse it could be. We are not there, you know, so let's not feed into this fear thing that I see happening of like, this is the worst. We're already in fascism. It's already Nazi. I'm like, no, it's actually not there yet. And saying that it is, right, and contributing to a little bit of all that trauma that gets, you know, echo chambered around us is not helping. How is it that we're sharing the light with each other of what's possible, of what's not happening here, of the atrocities that do happen to advocates in other countries? Because I would venture to say most people, including myself, hey, I was raised in this country. I came here when I was two. So I look at my mom's degree of toughness and I'm like, as tough as I seem, I'm pretty soft. And so I think it's really important to keep that perspective, that global perspective, because we owe a responsibility to the people in other countries to make sure it does not get that bad here, to make sure that in the belly of the beast, there is resistance and that we're not going passively into the night. And that's where I believe a lot of the folks in this room, you have such an important piece to play. Because when Trump started issuing his executive orders, I saw universities start scrubbing their language without being asked. I saw universities start deleting environmental justice. To be part of, first off, I was pretty proud, actually, that as a movement, we've gotten to a place where there is a president trying to erase us from history. Environmental justice, when I started, was not popular, okay? Even with the EJ law, I had Greens being the mainstream organizations, and I'll name them, right? They can call me. They know my number. National Resources Defense Council, Sierra Club, even my friends, Earth Justice. Like, a lot of them didn't fight with us because they didn't think it was politically feasible. A lot of the mainstream organizations were willing to sacrifice communities at the local level for the greater good. And we're never going to get anywhere when you start talking about sacrificing real people for this greater imaginary tomorrow, right? With the Envirals, we had a fight over carbon credit, creating like a crazy Wall Street of pollution that somehow was going to incentivize the people that created a problem. That's how I would explain tax credits, you know? They're like, no, it's a necessity. Bloomberg said so. Cool. But I would say in my neighborhood, those types of things never work. I don't want to carrot my way into compliance with people who are trying to kill us, because in our neighborhood, it's very clear. The industry wants to kill us, right? They put toxic chemicals, they put arsenic, mercury, dioxin into the air. That means they don't care about the kids who have to grow up in that neighborhood. That is not negotiable for me. So when it came to the Transportation Climate Initiative, another brilliant idea by mainstream environmental organizations, that they were going to do some like fancy formulas, control the price of gas, and don't worry, somehow industry wasn't just going to pass that on to the consumer, which I was like, that ends up being a gas tax. Like, you just gave me a whole presentation and I just heard gas tax. And in our neighborhood in Newark, right? Newark, so y'all know, it used to be white. Once upon a time, it used to be a white affluent neighborhood. It was going to rival New York City, right? Because it has a great placement. It's on the bay and it has a lot of access in and out. It didn't end up being that. It ended up being like second city in that area. But industry started landing there because of the river and that access. About 50 years ago, there was what we call the Newark Rebellion. Outsiders call it the Newark Riots, right? It was the time of another racial reckoning in this country. Because I would say we go on the merry-go-round on racial reckonings. And I knew in the uprisings after George Floyd that we were on one part of the racial merry-go-round and that it would come to this moment again. So the Newark Rebellion caused a lot of white flight from our neighborhood, and that caused a lot of disinvestment. And so in our neighborhood, there is a tension of like people need jobs. Because people do, I would say that no matter what, you know, your background is, race, gender, nationality, sexual orientation, people want to be able to support their families, right? We need to erase the idea of freeloaders. And if there are such a small percentage, don't stress about it. You know, like, people want to do good. I do fundamentally believe in the good of all people. And so if you believe in the good of all people, you have to acknowledge that there is a tension between economic development sometimes and then, unfortunate, there are resources around them. And so it has led our city to be in a precarious situation, to have to consider industry in exchange for jobs. And actually, that's often how we get held hostage, is by industries promising jobs. What's great for me is that a garbage incinerator doesn't have a lot of jobs. I can prove that. I can prove that that power plant is only going to have a couple of engineers, especially now. Technology runs it. But if we don't acknowledge that tension, if we minimize it, we isolate a big segment of the people that we're hoping to serve in a community. Because everyone wants a walkable downtown with flourishing business and things to happen. with the economic thing, we did manage in the rulemaking to make sure that economic was not a compelling public interest, because, you know, obviously industry wanted there to be exceptions for a compelling public interest. And we're like, yeah, compelling public interest means it benefits the host community. So if it's going to be a sludge plant, it better only deal with our sludge, not 12 states. So that was a pretty good thing about the law. And in case you're wondering why the fourth power plant, it came in before the law. It's a power plant I've been fighting since 2014. So not bad that we dragged it out for about 10 years. They just got approved, and we'll see if the financing holds true, because all of their plans are from more than a decade ago. The reason for that power plant, actually, and it's something everybody needs to watch out for, is because the sewage waste treatment facility, when we had Superstorm Sandy, right, which, yeah, hurricanes in the Northeast should not be that big of a deal, but, and it wasn't a hurricane, it was just a superstorm, but because our infrastructure is not set up, that we're not Florida, we're not set up to manage all that amount of water. It put the facility out for a couple of days, and as you can imagine, having raw sewage in the river is bad. It's also the reason our governor said we need a power plant, which, again, I had to fight a lot of, like, suburban environmentalists about the fact that I don't care if there's sludge once in the bay, because a power plant is going to be toxic to the neighborhood every single day as long as it exists. And if you build it, they will use it. There's no, like, oh, this is just for backup situations. The original permit was for, you know, for them to subsidize their energy cost, and they would save some money. Anyway, lost that fight. Really sad. And actually, it's one of my rules. Don't be a loser, okay? Because with our fights, sometimes we pick the big fights. And I've been hanging out with a lot of people. And so, yeah, we all want to fight racism. Can we have a campaign realistically to end racism today? Probably not. We need to figure out what's the one thing we can do. Is it achievable? And if you're going to fail, because there is a space for failure, but it needs to be meaningful failure. It can't just be your own ego, because I have been across the table of wonderful lawyers who let their ego kind of run and say, I'm going to make this campaign, it's going to set precedent. Even though it's going to set precedent and puts the community through a lot of emotional back and forth, right? It's really hard to sit there and witness failure after failure. For communities to trust us, we can't be losers, because no one wants to hang out with losers, right? I would say that's a pretty good thing that's shared across people, that if you feel like someone is constantly failing, maybe you don't want to associate with them. So how do we pick fights that invigorate our base, that invigorate our communities? If they're going to fight, it's a wonderful, spectacular fight, like Stop Newark. You know, with the fourth power plant, we had a lot of fun with the governor, who was originally just going to push it through. That was about 4 years ago, and he was going to push it through right after Christmas because he thought we weren't paying attention. Luckily for me, we don't really, you know, family time. Who needs that? My family totally understands why I need to be harassing the governor of our state over the Christmas weekend. So we were able to get the governor to back off and, again, delay it for 4 years. I think of every 4 years as a generation. When a kid grows up breathing in that air, even if everything else works out in their life, they're going to be scarred by the air that they're breathing in when they were a little kid, because little kids breathe faster than us. So they are more vulnerable to air pollution. You know, I've been doing this organizing thing since I was a kid. I was raised by a woman from Central America who wanted me to someday go back home and lead the revolution. That did not happen, obviously. I'm here in Eugene, Oregon, far, hopefully not too far from the revolution. But you know, I did get rooted in place. And actually, I didn't even take to environmental justice at first, because I didn't see it as, I didn't know that there was such a thing as environmental justice. Okay, let me be clear. I knew about the environmental stuff. And even though I grew up with a deep, like, reverence for the natural world based on, my cultural beliefs, I still thought it was kind of weird the way environmentalism happened, right? Of this sacred place of conserve it. Don't like interact with it. Like, I was like, that, I don't relate to that. That's weird that nature is somehow separate from us, not something we are of. I'm like, we are part of the natural world, right? So already there, environmentalism felt not for me. I thought it was a soft issue or maybe nice to get to issue, because in the community I grew up in, people were getting shot and evicted, right? There was police brutality that I could witness. I grew up being scared about my family crossing the border. And I want to be clear about this. People, at least, you know, a lot of the people I saw immigrating, they weren't really looking for a better life. It was American imperialism that was ruining our countries. Because as far as I think about, when I think about my country, it's paradise, right? It's people go vacation in a lot of our countries. And but they get access, you know, the tourists from America or Europe, they get access to parts of our country that we don't, right? We don't have the resources. Resources are extracted by multinational corporations. And then we're left to have to figure this out. So, of course, we come to the source of where, you know, if you follow people, you're following the money back to the U.S. It was really tied to my journey into environmental justice. I thought all those issues came first. I didn't realize that there was a movement that cared about all the issues together, that saw us as holistic human beings. And that is what environmental justice is supposed to do. Now, under Biden, it became really weird because all of a sudden environmental justice was on the national, like at the forefront of national politics. And I was really proud that the president had even spoken about our movement, that we were able to get the White House Environmental Justice Advisory Council off the ground, right? So that council, I guess there used to be the National Environmental Justice Advisory Council, NEJAC, and that only advised EPA. But that's actually a siloing of environmental justice, when environmental justice is supposed to be about the other departments too. I was so excited to think that Department of Transportation, Department of Labor, Department of Justice, that they all had to consider their role. I mean, you think about the toxic legacy left behind by military sites. You think about how, I mean, transportation is at the heart of civil rights, right? Of people being segregated from on a bus. So it was exciting to be able to have all departments have a holistic vision. I loved the whole of government approach, right? I never thought that I would have so much excitement around the presidency of a, you know, pretty old white guy. But his, you know, his approach to environmental justice, his administration, because that's the thing too. I don't believe in kings. It wasn't Joe Biden. It was all the staff around him, right? It was all everybody that got to serve in that administration. That what was powerful about the last 4 years. It was the exciting voices in government that were not really elevated or been given that freedom before. And I would say there was more diversity and excitement in Biden's administration than even in Obama, right? More uplifting of regular communities, because that's what Justice 40 was. It was a place for even neglected communities, you know, because I got asked by reporters a lot, what about poor white communities? I'm like, poor white folks have always been with us in the environmental justice movement. Because again, the environmental movement doesn't serve them either. They get left out or sacrificed or seen as backwards because they're attached to coal. But you're attached to the livelihood of your neighborhood. And so if you're trying to do good work, you have to know the heart of any community. Learn it and learn it well. Don't disrespect it, even if it might need a change, right? We need to really meet people where they're at. And so being elevated to the WEJAC was incredibly exciting, right? To think that someone from such a neighborhood-based perspective could have something to offer in a national forum across the country. And I think that's the solutions are actually from the very bottom all the way up. We have to go bottom up. It's never going to be top down. So we can't get too hung up on who is the front person. We have to always look at any politician, who's the team around them. And we're seeing the disaster team around the current administration, right? But who's the team around any of the leaders that we're going to put forth? Because I'm excited that, you know, hopefully I'll be an attendee here in 4 years and we'll be having a completely different conversation about how excited we are to go fight for the person, not how we're going to go fight against Trump. Because I think that's always been the problem. I don't want to fight against Trump. I don't want to fight against Trump's followers. I want to fight for somebody that's exciting and inspirational, right? Who tells things like it is. We do need to take some of that, and not tries to sugarcoat things. And while I was on the WEJAG, I advocated for humble government, because even in the Inflation Reduction Act, there was a lot of money, more than for environmental justice, on this process called carbon management, right? Which is also about carbon sequestration, about hydrogen, right? And so carbon sequestration is, you know, sucking carbon out of the air, and then we're going to let technology somehow put it into the ground, and then we're going to hope it works. And I'm sure that there's a lot of scientists. I mean, I was briefed by a lot of scientists that were like, this is a great thing. And don't worry, we've accounted for everything. I was part of a panel where the biggest consideration was not to prevent accidents. Because my thing is, sure, maybe CCS works someday, but we don't have that type of time, right? For something, a technology that is unproven, a technology that would be experimental. And guess where it would be happening? Our black and brown communities that are host to big oil and gas, right? That's where you're going to be sucking up the carbon. Then I found out that you suck up the carbon, that's EPA's problem. But then when the carbon is in the pipe, that's Department of Transportation. And then that's PHMSA. And I was like, oh no, like there's like 10 different regulatory agencies for a community to have to navigate their way through to hope that things are okay. And there was actually examples like in Kalamazoo where the pipeline leaked. And then there were people who passed out because carbon is an asphyxiant, right? It makes you pass out. I got to read firsthand accounts from responders who showed up to a scene and the cars were turned off because the air to the engine stopped and the people in it were passed out. I was like, that's the beginning of a horror movie, isn't it? And of course, it would be a horror movie bought on by human arrogance. I'm saying, we got this. I have gotten to hang out with very powerful people who, you know, at our foundations. They were just like, that's human error. Every, you know, nuclear disaster has just been human error. And I was like, interesting. They're like, if only we had a better process. And I'm like, shouldn't you build in human error? Because human error will always happen. And so maybe keep those fixes apart. During the WEJAG process, we did have two series of recommendations on carbon management, against carbon management, very clear. Carbon management is not the way to go. We're wasting our time if we think we're going to solve climate change through, you know, a complete belief in an experimental technology. Technology is not going to save us. What's going to save us is relationships to each other, of making sure that we're able to build a successful future, right? That we stop picking fights that don't make sense because of our own egos, and we pick fights that make sense to the people, that the people are behind you, that they're invested. Because when they're invested, and fighting should be fun, you know? Because what else is there to lose? The other side wants to kill us. I think they've made that very clear. So if we're going to fight back, we should fight back like people who have nothing to lose. We can't hang out at home waiting for them to come for us. We need to be with each other, making this as fun as possible. And actually, that's what I was able to do. I got this wonderful opportunity a few years ago through the Tishman Center. The Tishman Center had a fellowship for environmental justice leaders. And what was radical about it was there was no agenda. You know, it was, first off, we were able to be with other leaders, which, you know, I was running the environmental justice work at Ironbound at the time. And I realized that I never had time to even develop the relationships with my own colleagues. They were happening a little bit quickly at lunch or a little bit at the bar if you had enough stamina to stick around. But the agenda was packed. It was packed with workshops and brainstorms and whatever. That is not the best use of time, people, okay? Especially when you're not letting people be organic. So at the Tishman Fellowship, I came in with other leaders like Rawa from Push Buffalo, Dwayne Tyndall from ACE, Alternatives for Community Environment in Boston, and Mia Yoshitami from APEN, which is Asian Pacific for APEN, Environmental Network. Thank you. I would say all of us are from different corners, really holding our own and having legacy fights. We were able to just be together, and we're given space to like have our own agenda, because leaders are often just brought into the room so that other people can pick their brains, right? Sometimes people offer me payment to come and just share whatever I got, but the relationship stays transactional, right? It doesn't become a transformative relationship about how we actually building a relationship that goes beyond this work. Because nothing about what any of you in this room want to do is could be called a job. You're not deciding to become accountants, okay? You're deciding to change the world, right? Because policy is about making the world in your image, in the image of the community and the values that you see. So we need to make sure that the people we're changing policy with, that we actually know them as human beings. We know what are their values, and we are building with people we trust and feel good about, right? Because if you do lose, you want to be with people you trust and you feel good about. And when you win, you want to celebrate with people that you feel good and you trust. And now more than ever, we're going to need those bonds that hold us together, right? Because all this terror and fear on different attacks, because they've got us segmented into different parts of our identity, right? Into our sexual orientation or our nationality. And then we're here having conversations about language when we need to be having more global, holistic conversations about, you know, what is the world that we want to see? And as government burns down, we need to think about how we're going to rebuild government, the government that we deserve as people. And the only way to know that is by listening, you know, to people and having conversations with as many people as possible, having rooms that are filled with people you've never seen before. And this might sound like I'm telling you to reach out to MAGA, okay? So let me be clear there. I think there's a bunch of people you're not talking to, okay? It's not just like people who are diehard MAGA, even though they might be in your family, and that's cool too. You can go try. But I would say that most of the time organizers focus on the extremes, and then we leave out all the people in the middle. And that's so many people in the middle. Organizer math is if you want 10 people in the room, you should have talked to 100. And that sounds crazy, but it's not. I mean, the best businesses have been built on robocalls to many people. And do you want to buy this? So you need to take the time to have all the people in the middle and talk to them. And that doesn't mean you move to the middle. I don't know if there's left and right, okay? We've allowed a lot of our beliefs to become radical. There is nothing radical about us, okay? We're not actually talking about, you know, taking all the land from rich people. Come on, I've not really heard that be the request. It's often like, I want clean water to drink. You know, we can't let that line of normalcy be moved so far away from us. We need to reclaim that it's normal to want clean air to breathe, you know, healthy food to eat, and healthy land. So that's not crazy or radical. I think I'm kind of done.
You were just listening to Maria Lopez Nunez on environmental justice. She spoke at the University of Oregon in Eugene in March. Maria Lopez Nunez, an environmental justice organizer and eco-activist, is the deputy director of the Ironbound Community Corporation in Newark, New Jersey. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature voices rarely heard in the corporate media, such as Gabor Mate, Shama Sawant, Tariq Ali, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Arundhati Roy, and Winona LaDuke. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Maria Lopez Nunez on Environmental Justice, and for the Howard Zinn classic book, A People's History of the United States, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Matt Laubach recorded the program. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
fact is that algorithms are the underlying technology of missile defense. Algorithms happen to be the perfect weapon for executing commands in real time to automated weapons over huge expanses of geography. Algorithms, which were shaped for war, now shape civilization writ large. Digital technologies blur any distinction between civil society and a military state that may have existed.
That's Kuhan Pakmander, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Kuhan Pakmander on algorithms, digital technologies, and warfare. Algorithms, the dictionary tells us, are a process or set of rules to be followed in calculations or other problem-solving operations, especially by computer. Sounds innocuous enough, but hang on, it has a dark side. Algorithms can make mistakes due to biases, poor design, coding errors, or flawed assumptions. They can collect and process large amounts of personal data, which can put people's privacy rights at risk. And there are lethal dangers. Kuhan Pakmander warns the algorithms that missiles have spawned have been a scourge on Mother Earth and our own humanity with our smartphones, satellites, robotics, and AI, and all the rest, through which civil society has unwittingly become militarized through and through. Our guest today is Kuhan Pakmander. She's a journalist, author, and peace and environmental activist. Her articles appear in The Nation, The Progressive, Foreign Policy in Focus, and other publications. And now, Kuhan Pakmander.
Our nation, the United States of America, continues to bankroll two horrible wars. One, an off-the-rails genocide in Gaza that has expanded into Lebanon, and the other one, a brutalization of Ukraine and Russia that has dragged on for years. And yet another one that is in the planning stages, which warmongers view as the big prize, and that is war with China. These wars are being conducted with unprecedented